Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I have many places beyond the domain of my house where I also feel at home. Such a connection can establish itself really very quickly. Staying in a strange city, a bar where I sit in the same spot to have a drink on my own, becomes before long my local bar, welcoming and familiar, despite the fact that 2 days previously I didn't know it existed. But of course, it's not always like that. Some places gain such status over time. For over 20 years, bar lockdown, illness and the occasional trip, my mum and I have met in the same place, a cafe, each Saturday at 10:15. That probably amounts to well over 1,000 times that we have sat opposite each other across the table in this place. I say 10:15, but in reality, I have been more often than not late. I proffer my usual flurry of excuses used for over 20 years. The taxi was late, the bus was late, I'd been up working from early and had forgotten the time. I met someone I knew on the way. These excuses are always accepted graciously, if disbelievingly. My mom looks smart. "You should dress well when you go into town," she's always said, "because you never know who you might meet." But in 20 years in this cafe, we have never met anyone out of the ordinary, if such a thing as an ordinary person can be said to exist. Material conditions have changed over the years. The cafe used to be in the basement at the far end of the food hall. It was chilly and had the utilitarian ambience of a Soviet workers' canteen. We went down in the lift with a baby in a buggy. Not so long after, we went down in the lift with a baby in a buggy and a little kid. And then the cafe moved upstairs to reside next to Homeware. Still we went every week. Still we go every week. There are other places, more modish, more artisan, less bland, but we don't diversify because this place means Saturday morning. And always the same order, 2 coffees and a slice of cake, which we share. There have been various cakes over the years. Coffee was a favourite, but is now defunct. You serve yourself the cakes with a metal slice now, but you used to have to ask to have it done for you. The minutiae of the cafe, the grammar of its operation, is noticed by us. The precise positioning of metal tubs of cutlery, the new coffee machines, the new mugs, the old mugs, the sudden arrival of an artificial tree. The people who work there, we notice them too. The friendly, the funny, the girl with the amazing eye makeup who looked like a Shangri-La, the guy from ages ago, the one with the country accent who was always wearing last night's eyeliner. He's not forgotten. Some customers we see most weeks, the woman with the mobility scooter, the child with the patent shoes, the mother with the 2 children. We remember when she was pregnant. We wonder where some familiar faces are who no longer appear. Occasionally, my dad would turn up unexpectedly in the cafe. Although he is dead 6 years, we do still half expect that to happen. When we see them, we love to say hello to a couple who were in the cafe at the same time for many years before we spoke. We've never seen them anywhere outside this place. We know the rhythms. Coming up to Christmas, there's a queue of people who come to town only very irregularly. We roll our eyes. They do not put in our hours at the cafe. James Joyce had said, considered Ernest Hemingway's A Clean, Well-Lighted Place as one of the best short stories ever written. I like it too. It's about a cafe late at night. And this cafe in the story is a shelter, a refuge from empty, meaningless existence. Our nada, who art in nada, nada be thy name, thy kingdom nada, thy will be nada, in nada as it is in nada. The cafe, bright and clean, is a temporary home. I'm not thinking that that's what it is for us or for me, Saturday morning at 10:15, although I understand that story and feel an affinity with it. Anyhow, my mum says, taking a sip of coffee, as she moves nimbly from one subject to another, from funerals to shades of foundations, to the point of it all, to the newspaper article she has clipped out about someone I knew 40 years ago. Anyhow, she says, anyhow.
So, where are you from? It seems like a simple question, but it makes me sweat. I was chatting to this man on the street, asked the question, and he answered, Atticall. Now, Atticall is a small parish in County Down near Kilkeel, up in the Mourne Mountains. Heart of the Mournes, he says, heart of the Mournes. Born and reared, 100%, never moved, never left. The brother lives up the road, the sister lives down the road. And as he talked on, I was envious of his easy sense of belonging somewhere, because that's not me. What part of the world are you from yourself? I knew you'd ask this. And then my mind started spinning. I mean, the short answer is I'm from Newry, full stop. Sometimes that opens a conversation, sometimes it closes one. The long answer is I'm from Newry, brackets, the County Down side, close brackets. My father was from Katy in County Armagh. My mother was born in Roscavvy in County Tyrone. I came to Belfast 30 years ago, met my wife, who's from Derry City, married her, never went home. I have relations in Monaghan, Galway, Selbridge, Northampton, and I live in Sainfield in County Down. But I just said Newry. I've actually been out of Newry and in and around this city of Belfast far longer than I was ever at home. And still, only last week, half a mile from here in Bedford Street, I was approached by two American tourists who wanted directions. And I found myself explaining, well, no, I'm not actually from Belfast. I'm from Newry, it's about 40 miles south of here. And Bob and Carol from Cleveland, Ohio, God bless them, lovely couple, who just wanted directions to the post office. Got a bit more than they bargained for, but I can't help it. We're in leafy South Belfast here, and I know all around this art centre so well. You go out the front door and turn to the right, takes you down Shaftesbury Square into the Golden Mile, the Dublin Road, and you're in the city centre in 10 minutes. In a bar about 10 doors down from here, in my first week up in the Big Smoke as a student, 1998, an older woman leaned across the bar and bellowed, buy me a pint of strong beer and I'll show you a good time. And 17-year-old me was just mortified and left. A left turn out of here takes you up along the front of Lanyon's beautiful Queen's University, where I passed whole nights in the music department trying to get work finished and handed in on time. On up past the Friars Bush graveyard, where the road suddenly narrows to avoid the cholera mound from the 1830s, and I once saw the ghost of a girl in a Victorian nightdress wafting between the graves there. On up the hill then into Stranmillis, and Strachan Millish, the sweet stream. Many happy hours passed up there looking out the window of 143A Stramulus Road on the world going past our student flat, and then down past the sharp red brick angles of the Lyric Theatre, and you're onto the embankment. And then down along the Laggan embankment, you have the Holy Lands. For anyone not familiar with Belfast, the Holy Lands, or the Lands, is an area of terraced red brick streets between the Laggan and the university with names like Palestine Street, Cairo Street, Damascus Street, Jerusalem Street. They're all mostly multi-occupant rental properties and home to what estate agents would probably call a vibrant mix of ethnic minorities and students. But the point is, while I know the geography of this bit of Belfast, I feel at the same time at home and not at home here. I've never adopted the "so you do," for example. You know, the way that people in Belfast often reinforce the importance of what they've just said by adding a wee "so you do" at the end of a sentence. Yous do that. So yous do. Yous are all melters. So yous are. I got in a Belfast taxi many years ago in the days when they still had radios to talk to the depot. And as we pulled away, this distorted female voice from taxi headquarters kept breaking through the static and crackle, calling out to the taxi drivers. 42, 42. Oh, yeah. And it was so loud, so Belfast. And the taxi man had it turned up full. And after a minute, I said to him, "How do you listen to that?" And he never took his eyes off the road. And he came out with this immortal line. He went, "Your woman? Aye. She's a voice like a fire in a pet shop." A voice like a fire in a pet shop. And to be honest, quite a number of Belfast people have voices like fires in pet shops. And sometimes some Belfast people, he said bravely while his wife hopefully runs outside and starts the car, some Belfast people do genuinely feel that the world ends at the city limits. And I know that can be any city, to be fair. But a family from this city were having a big wedding in Donegal, and two of their old aunts didn't show up at the hotel. And further inquiries in the afternoon revealed that the elderly pair, who maybe hadn't travelled outside Belfast too much, had set out for Donegal and ended up in Balbriggan. "What the hell took you to Balbriggan?" said the nephew on the phone. "Well, we just got on the motorway and followed the big blue signs for the south." "Sure, Donegal's in the south." And that's so Belfast. One of the greatest Newry men of all time was a man called Sean Hollywood. He was an English teacher, an actor, a theatre director, and a political activist from Newry, very much involved in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And I remember asking him, with all his success in local drama, with all his legendary skills in public speaking, why he never moved away from Newry to Dublin or to London, maybe. And he said, "People wouldn't say hello to me there. And nowadays, probably more people would say hello to me here in Belfast than would back in Newry." So I suppose that makes Belfast my adopted city. I don't know, do I adopt it? What's the procedure? Or does it adopt me? But at the same time, I did answer our friend from Attical properly. I'm from Newry. But if you Belfast people don't mind, I think after 30 years, I kind of belong here. So I do.
When you're out walking and there's no one near you, but a voice keeps calling, and you hear your name. It's not the leaves or the whispering breeze.
Early April and sunset in Dubrovnik, and I pause at the head of a steep flight of steps in the old walled city. The steps, the whole city, are cut in golden stone, and they glow in the evening light. The sight is warming, though the air is certainly not. The bora, the ferocious wind which, from time to time, scours the coasts of the Adriatic, is just ebbing after days of gales. Yesterday we endured, well, let's just call it a bumpy landing at the local airport. The cabin was completely silent as we descended, and when we touched down, we were told that the previous day, no flights had been able to land at all. The evening sky is blue then, but the wind is icy, and summer feels a long way off still. There has been a sound these last few minutes, just on the edge of hearing, coming almost into focus and then ebbing away again. I had even glanced up into the sky and spotted them whirling and wheeling high above the red roofs and golden domes of the city, black against the blue of the sky. Crows, I thought, if I thought anything at all. No, I couldn't have thought anything at all. I was too pleased with golden Dubrovnik to think about these black, wheeling shapes and the sound they made, the screaming, the screeching. But now my husband looks into the blue air and stops at the head of the golden steps, and he calls aloud, "The swifts are here." Yes, the swifts are here on the Adriatic coast already. Earliest April, and the swifts are here. The swifts have reached the Mediterranean on their long summer journey from the rainforests of the Congo. They're on their way home. To our home, we hope. A few years ago, we had swift nesting boxes set high on the wall of our house in Dublin. Just under the eaves, a north-facing wall, a clear runway to land, everything just as they like it. The very boxes were bespoke, designed and constructed for swifts and for no other bird. They arrived in the post from a kind friend who had ordered them and then realised she had no place to position them. "Try them out," she said. "You never know." The swifts are just one more species in trouble. They rely for nesting sites on old nooks and crannies and crevices and roofs of old buildings. Our mania for restoration, for sealing and repairing, doesn't suit them at all. They are increasingly homeless in our cities, meaning no eggs, no young, no future generations. They navigate by the night sky. At dusk, they rise high into the atmosphere and take their bearing by the stars, which imprint themselves on their minds. And the swifts remember, year by year, how to steer, how to find their way to their summer homes. Break this transmission, no nesting site, no eggs, no young, and it's gone forever, and their relatives will go elsewhere. We set our swift nesting boxes on the north-facing wall of the house then, and we even played the recorded calls that are recommended by the books. And we waited, and we waited. They didn't come to settle with us. We saw them arrive the first year, flying and circling over the neighbourhood, scouting and exploring. But they didn't come to nest with us. And the same the second year. "Don't worry," said the books. "It usually takes them 3 or so years to decide that, yes, you'll do." 3 years is the charm. It means a good deal to me, the idea that the swifts might choose to come and spend their fleeting summer season at our place. It staves off the loneliness that I think humans are increasingly experiencing as the Anthropocene the human age proceeds, and as we pick off species after species to leave more room for us. We feel, as well as know, that we are part of a great, immeasurably complex ecosystem. We feel, as well as know, that we cannot forever pick off bits and branches of this ecosystem without eventually destroying the whole of it. And we feel, as well as know, the grief and, yes, the loneliness that comes from being increasingly alone on the planet. And this explains maybe why I stock still at the head of a flight of golden steps in Dubrovnik on an icy blue sky April day. The swifts are screaming overhead and heading north, and this is the third year since we acquired our swift boxes. And the third year is the charm. Thank you.
Here's two poems. The first one is called Postscript. What we did to the earth, we did to our daughters, one after the other. What we did to the trees, we did to our elders, stacked in their wheelchairs by the lunchroom door. What we did to our daughters, we did to our sons, calling out for their mothers. What we did to the trees, what we did to the earth, we did to our sons, to our daughters. What we did to the cow, to the pig, to the lamb, we did to the earth, butchered and milked it. Few of us knew what the bird calls meant or what the fires were saying. We took of earth and took and took, and the earth seemed not to mind until one of our daughters shouted, "It was right in front of you, right in front of your eyes, and you didn't see." The air turned red. The ocean grew teeth. My daughter is, I just learned this word, directionally dyslexic. Is anybody here? She cannot tell right from left. It's a funny term. Are you all laughing because it's funny? It is funny, but and for years I didn't believe her, but it's true. I just met a friend, another poet in the United States called Kimiko Han, who has the same situation. My daughter cannot tell what's right and what's left. She's left-handed. I say, what's left is on your left hand. It doesn't happen. It's a brain thing, right? So this poem is dedicated to her. It's a small poem. It's called The Map. The failure of love might account for most of the suffering in the world. The girl was going over her global studies homework in the air, where she drew a map with her finger, touching the Gobi Desert, the plateau of Tiber in front of her, and looking through her transparent map backwards, I suddenly did see how her left is my right. And for a moment, I understood. Thank you.
Thank you. I am in Dumfries. It's a smallish town. Martin says, as we walk to the pub, it's bid to be seen as a city field. Oh dear, I say. I hope that's not a sign and a Dumfries doesn't feel me or us, as we're new and we've potential. I don't tell Martin I'd read that the nickname for the town is the Queen of the South. I save it for later, as there's an easy laugh to be had there. And it's my first visit to his. We may have some awkward moments that need lightening. Walking down the high street, the usual shops are all present, just like any town in the UK. I love looking above shop fronts, I say. When I lived in London, I'd ride upstairs on double-deckers. You'd see how beautiful the buildings once were. The bricks the buildings here are made from are large and dark grey. Some might say it makes the place look dull or austere. I find the colour and the size of the stone comforting. I feel safe, sturdy, important. In the middle of the street before us, a beautiful old rectangular building. It looks like it's been here longer than everything at either side, like the high street has been built around it. It wouldn't look out of place on a postcard, or when I saw it again the following night, its old lamps shining through a vague mist at a group of tourists standing huddled by its steps, like a scene on a Christmas card. Martin says he gets it, that weddings take place in it nowadays, and that makes sense to my eyes. What makes less sense is when he tells me it was originally a prison. I can't make that work in my head, but it's a fact. I try to wash away what I've painted over this place. I try to restore it to the original, but I can't. I see what I see. Painted hoardings push out into the high street, blocking the view of the lower floor of the building on the left. It's deceiving, Martin says. It looks like another shop front in the row, but this building goes really far back. He points to the sky. At the top of that one, there's a roof garden. I can't see any hint of it. Here, he says, the statue of Robert the Bruce. This is where he... And I miss what he says, because my eyes have taken priority for receiving. In the church behind, he says. Although that's not where the church was when it actually happened. Tourists go to see this famous spot, but Martin points across the square. The church was over there originally. That's where it really happened, he says. It's a Greg's Bakery now. We go to the Doogie, the closest thing Dumfries has to a gay bar. It's a blast. DJs and drag queens and a girl from Newry who tells me how raging she is she didn't get to be Irish because she's a big prod. She makes jokes about Catholics being dirty and having too many children, and something I don't hear that must have gone really below the belt because it made the people run from the table with raised eyebrows and ducked heads. I think they were expecting the second troubles, but I bought her a drink. I like her. I'm surprised and soothed that the younger generation are carrying on the Northern Irish humour that can clear a room faster than a bomb scare. Martin and I walk home, back up the high street, seeing it in reverse. I'm warm with alcohol and connection. I take his hand. Is it safe here? I ask. The usual, he says. We make our way off the high street and round a corner. It's a little darker. I look at the building ahead, look above, and see the flats above the shop front. One night, I heard someone shouting abuse at me and my friend from there. He pointed at the flats I was looking at. We weren't even a couple, but they knew. We turned back and saw a guy hanging out of that window. There was a party going on. So we shouted back at him, and we weren't expecting him to go mad and him and his mates to run out and chase us, but we were faster. He's telling me this as we walk towards that flat. I would have walked home a different way if I lived here. The cartography of this town has changed in my eyes. We walk around the corner and some lads are swaying towards us and one bangs off a lamppost. I let go of Martin's hand, but he links my arm, maybe to make me feel safe, maybe to insist that we shouldn't have to stop being ourselves. I'm uncomfortable, but I'm concentrating on every move these guys make and where their eyes are resting. But they are too drunk to focus on anything other than putting one foot in front of the other. After they have passed, we're silent, and I feel like a coward. I'm rooting around in my head for something to say I remember about the Queen of the South, but I can't make it funny. I take Martin's hand instead, and we share a kiss in the street without a care of who sees, the way two people with potential should.
We're going to sing a song that first started out as a poem written by the Scots poet Robert Tannahill in the 18th century. It contains the lyrics, "And merrily we'll sing as the storms rattle o'er us." And in the 20th century, it was picked up by a Belfast family, the McPeaks, and they made it their own. So we'd love to sing with you, if you know the words, "Wild Mountain Time."
On this morning's programme, we heard "Cafe" by Wendy Erskine. "Where Are You From?" was by John Toll. "Swift Boxes" by Neil Hegarty. "Postscript" and "The Map," two poems by Marie Howe. And "Queen of the South" was by Paul McVeigh. The music was "Tea for Two" by Vincent Yeomans, played by Scott Flanagan on keyboard. "The County Down" by Tommy Sands, sung by Jack Warnock. "Blackbird" by The Beatles, played by Scott Flanagan on keyboard. "The Mushroom Tree and the Kid on the Mountain," played by Emer McKeown on whistle and Donna Hennessy on guitar. And "Wild Mountain Time" by True. You can listen back to the programme on the RTE radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.